I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and NPR's own political editor Ken Rudin. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Jimmy.
Hey.
Doing good, man. Hey.
Hey, man, making it do what it do. Well, she's back. That's right. While President Obama was away this week hobnobbing in Asia, guess who decided to step back into the spotlight? Former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. She is...
Payton, as in Payton Place? Were you having a moment?
Right, exactly. She's promoting her book, and as it happens, she's around my way. And if I wasn't on the show, I'd probably be camped out trying to get my copy.
Yep.
Of Going Rogue. Michelle, what do you think about that?
I don't know, Ken, what do you think about that? I guess the question I think all of us have is, do you think she's really running? Is she testing the waters for another political career?
Well, you mean on Earth? Well, see, the problem is, I mean, Jimmy says she's back. She's never left. I mean, the thing is, of course, she has this book, Going Rogue. And, of course, that was the title that the McCain people gave her because McCain the Maverick didn't like the fact that Sarah Palin was even more of a maverick. So, you know, the book, there's some things about the book that you almost feel for her. The abuses that she took about her children, I think the over the top questions about whether it was her real child or not, something. I mean, some of the questions were really beyond the pale. But when it comes down to the basic questions, why did you resign as governor of Alaska, as Peyton would say? Why couldn't you answer the Katie Couric question about what books or magazines or lawn signs you may have read in your life? There were so many things that she didn't answer. So you think that ultimately she is leading towards a 2012 candidacy. You saw her involvement in that upstate New York congressional seat where she played a major role in marshaling conservative support. And yet on basic questions, she still doesn't seem to have the kind of answers one would expect in a presidential candidate.
Hmm. Ruben, what do you think?
I think she's a fascinating person to watch, and whether you love her or hate her, people can't look away from her. I think it's one of the reasons that she's going to generate all this money and has generated money in books and speaking fees and the like. People, even media outlets that don't like her, and I happen to work for one of them, I think it's fair to say CNN does not have a positive opinion of Sarah Palin. And yet when you go onto the website, you see that her stories are prominently displayed because everybody makes money from Sarah Palin, even people who don't like her, because we have this fascination with her. I think one of the most important things to come out of the debate, frankly, was what we learned about class differences and elitism. And interestingly enough, the one defender that Sarah Palin had of note was Bill Clinton, who doesn't agree with her politically on many issues. But Clinton said to the elitists in the Democratic Party and around the country, he said, you know, I got the same sort of treatment in 1992 when people saw me coming from Arkansas. This is really dangerous stuff, he says, because what you are missing is that there's a reason that 20,000, 30,000 people show up at rallies for Sarah Palin. And I think that was a very profound thing for Clinton to say, because I remember in the day in 92 when Clinton was first running and first gone national, Paul Tsongas, Jerry Brown, his opponents, they all sort of like put him off as coming from the backwoods and come on and all this other stuff, Jennifer Flowers and all this. And I think that Clinton was hitting on something really important, which is we have a tendency as Americans to look down on one another. And just like folks looked down and underestimated Bill Clinton, so they are estimating Sarah Palin.
Okay, but that gives the lie to the notion that this is somehow because she's a Christian conservative, you know, evangelical. I mean, because you're saying there's a double standard. It's a double standard because I'm a Christian. It's a double standard because I'm a woman. Bill Clinton is a Christian, but he's not a conservative Christian. He's not a woman. And yes, it is true. He had to face some of the same questions. And the other thing that I would point out that is that, you know, her chief antagonists are within her own party. The people who first started leaking negative and critical information about her were people who were on the ticket that selected her.
Same
so I guess I Clinton. Just think that, you know, what's the issue here that nobody's allowed to... Anyway, Arsalan, you want to get into this. Well, Arsalan's giving us these really weird, like he can't decide, like if he wants her to go away or...
I mean, I can decide. I mean, I am completely sick and tired of hearing about Sarah Palin, and I think that, you know, there are many people...
Hater!
Listen, I think there
Socialist!
There are a lot of people, you know... Who, you know, again, you know, she essentially is a political has-been in the sense that, you know, we didn't see Lloyd Bentsen come out after, you know, he lost, you know, as the vice presidential candidate. But, and more importantly, you know, you talk about all this, you know, hateration against Sarah Palin. I think it revolves around the fact that in terms of political substance, she has about as much political substance as Ken Rudin's pinky finger. And now, you know, she's going on her little honky-tonk, badonkadonk book tour, you know, promoting her book. You know, she's making money.
How dare you insult my pinky finger?
Sorry, she has a right to make money.
No, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that, you know, for someone who can see Russia from the back porch of their house, it's just, who said that?
Tina Fey said that.
What?
You know what?
She never said that. Tina Fey said that.
Right.
She's on Saturday Night Live now.
But she did say, well, in one of her interviews with, I can't remember whether it was with Barbara Walters or Oprah Winfrey, she did, I think it was with Barbara Walters, who talked on more political topics with her. She did talk about her credential being Alaska's proximity to Russia. She actually kind of defended the concept. Anyway, Jimmy, you were trying to say something.
I was just saying, A-Train, you know, you're really hard on Sarah Palin. I don't know that anybody's going to mistake me for a Sarah Palin supporter, but you know what? Don't count her out, because her appeal was also her Achilles heel. Her appeal is that everybody knows Sarah Palin. They know a Sarah Palin. She's the neighbor. She's that woman at the beauty salon. She might even be the cashier at the Piggly Wiggly. You know, but the problem is, the cashier at the Piggly Wiggly probably wouldn't run, you know, on the Republican ticket as the vice presidential candidate. And for me, she was thrown in by the McCain camp as kind of this, it was a convenience thing. She wasn't prepped properly, but I don't know. I wouldn't sleep on her. I wouldn't sleep on her in 2012, because she taps into that every person, every man, every woman quality that a lot of people want back in the White House.
Except, be careful. I agree with you on that in terms of her personal biography. But where she doesn't tap into that every man, every woman quality is with a lack of empathy. I mean, she has this very unusual biography, but she seems to have very little interest in other people whose biographies are unusual. The way she ridiculed Barack Obama as a community organizer, for example, saying, I was a small town mayor. I guess that's like being a community organizer with actual responsibilities. What if he'd been a missionary? Would she have ridiculed him? What if he had been a missionary and doing the same thing a community organizer does?
Empathy is important, Michelle, but there's a lot of folks out there. I could list 10 off the top of my head, successful Democratic politicians who lack empathy. And I think that's not necessarily a disqualifier. What's always bothered me is the double standard. I mean, we'll go forward in the media and say, you know, she got all these things wrong. But every time Joe Biden made a flub or a mistake or just, you know, flat out said Teddy Roosevelt went on Franklin Delano Roosevelt went on television, you know, then people like Clarence Page, my friend at the Chicago Tribune, would shrug and say, oh, that's just Joe.
I don't agree with you. How do you know that's about these flubs? Standard. It's because people wrote about it. Anyway, Ken wanted to get into
this. Plus the fact that if we're talking about her lack of empathy, well, take a look at another vice presidential candidate, John Edwards, who faked empathy, who talked about his empathy towards women. And you saw what he was doing to women behind his back.
Who is the only national politician less favorably approved of than Sarah Palin.
But for a long time, Arsalan talked about her as a has-been. When John Edwards' ticket lost in 2004, he wasn't a has-been. He was a front-runner for 2008 until somebody like Hillary and Barack Obama came along.
Well, until you cheat on your cancer-stricken wife.
Exactly.
I mean, there's that.
So there's empathy, says, there's a lack a of empathy, look. And there's fake empathy, and I don't know which one is worse.
Well, so anyway, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the barbershop with Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Ruben Navarrete, and Ken Rudin. Can I just ask briefly, are you guys going to read the book?
No.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I'm totally going to read it.
Absolutely.
Jimmy, yes. So. Jimmy, yes. Ken, yes. Arsalan, no. Ruben, what about you?
No.
No? Really?
No.
How come?
I mean, no. I'm defending her, but I mean, you know, you're asking me if I'm interested in the subject matter. I think we understand what's in this book already. I think if you pay attention to enough interviews, you're getting a lot of what's in the book.
I'm going to read it. Ken, you going to let me borrow your copy?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because, you know, times are still tough around here. Anyway, Jimmy, you had something else you wanted to talk about.
Well, you know what? Earlier this week, Attorney General Eric Holder defended his decision to try 5 co-conspirators in the 9/11 attacks in a civilian court in New York. Michelle?
Yeah, so the question is, of course, should he be tried in civilian court? And do you think that, I mean, obviously this is causing all kinds of angina with people who think, and Arsalan, of course, you're our civil rights attorney in the mix. And the question is this the appropriate venue? And does this expose this, whatever venue is selected for a trial, does it expose them to additional risks? And are those risks warranted by whatever principle is at issue by holding a civilian trial. So what's your take on this?
Those are very good questions, Michelle. And generally speaking, within the American legal system, both civilian criminal trials and military criminal trials are essentially the same except for the rules of evidence. You know, the matters of military criminal justice are usually governed by the Universal Code of Military Justice, or the UCMJ. Now, let's not forget that there are five other people who are going to be tried in military commissions for the attack on the USS Cole in 2000 in Yemen. And so essentially what the sort of philosophy that the Justice Department is taking is civilian trial for civilian crimes or civilian victims and military trials for military victims. The USS Cole off the port of Sana'a, Yemen, was a purely military target. Let's not forget Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was not captured on the battlefield. He was actually arrested by Pakistani security forces in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, on an arrest warrant. And so, you know, to me, it's funny. The argument that I always bring up to, you know, my conservative debaters when I do debate them is that had President Bush had, you know, decided that KSM and his, you know, four people were going to a civilian court, I hardly think we would be hearing a peep from the neoconservative crowd. I think they'd be touting, you know, how great our American justice system is. And if anybody challenged, you know, the veracity of that, you know, we probably would have been called unpatriotic. But now that we have, I think there is a double standard.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of a hypothetical. But let me just play a short clip from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Attorney General Eric Holder was called before the Senate Judiciary Committee to talk about the security risk. And this is what Lindsey Graham had to say. Here it is.
Under domestic criminal law, the moment the person is in the hands of the United States government, they're entitled to be told they have a right to a lawyer and can remain silent. And if we go down that road, we're going to make this country less safe. That is my problem with what you have done.
And I'll just play a short clip of Attorney General Eric Holder's response. Here it is.
I'm not going to base a determination on where these cases ought to be brought on what a terrorist, what a murderer wants to do. He will not select the prosecution venue. I will select it, and I have.
You know, one of the problems that kind of jumps out at me right here is that, Ruben, you talked about this. They've already convicted him in their public utterances.
Yes, they have.
So that raises some questions. I don't know, Ruben, if
here's the deal. I could make very easily the Lindsey Graham argument attacking this from the right. I think that exchange between Graham. Graham's a smart guy. I think Graham, that exchange with Holder was an important one. A lot of Americans don't like the idea. 70-80% of Americans don't like the idea of a Mirandizing. You have the right to remain silent, terrorism suspects. Okay, so that's, I think, a loser for Holder. But I'm going to take this on from the left, not from the right. The fact that during an NBC interview with Chuck Todd, the president would in China say that people are going to feel better about what happens to KSM when he is convicted and given the death penalty, okay, prejudging his guilt and the punishment, is problematic from a legal point of view. Already appeals are kind of coming up. The president's already done this, close the door.
Right, how do you get a fair trial?
And then a fair hanging, right?
Right.
So the point is, what happened to innocent until proven guilty? This whole fig leaf somehow that the reason they move on to civilian court is so they can have all these glorious, you know, U.S. protections, American protections in our judicial system. One of them is innocent until proven guilty. Obama just shot that to heck. The other thing is Holder went before Congress and said as a way – see, Holder and Obama are being pushed by the right wingers to be real hardline on this. And so what Holder said to Congress was, we will not let anybody go. Even if they're acquitted at trial, we're not going to let them go if we think they're a threat to Americans. Mm. So basically what you said there now is due process out the window. So this thing's a joke, the fact that somehow you move KSM to civilian court, but then you summarily take away all his rights. What are we doing?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, both Ken and Arsalan wanted to get on this. Arsalan briefly, then Ken.
Well, Ruben, you bring up some great points. And the FBI has formed things called clean teams, essentially, to look at the evidence that was procured before the 183 times that he was waterboarded. And so they obviously think that they have the evidentiary burden of proof to be able to get that conviction, which is one of the reasons why they're bringing him to civilian court. And most importantly, let's not forget that Ramzi Youssef, who was convicted in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and who also happens to be Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, is already serving a life sentence in Supermax in Colorado in solitary confinement, and we haven't heard a peep from him since.
Arsalan, let me push back on this a second. The civilian target business, this is a fig leaf, again, of the administration. Explain to me why on 9/11, when the Pentagon was attacked, the Pentagon is not a military target. You don't become any more military target than the Pentagon.
No, but again, KSM was not a member of any military. He was captured by civilian forces in Rawalpindi,
Pakistan.
But you
said it had everything to do with the targets. You bought the holder line. That's
a
lie.
No.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. We need to give Ken a chance to get into this, and then
two quick things. First of all, Giuliani said the argument against having KSM tried is that suddenly New York City would become a major terrorist target, as if New York City is not a terrorist target anyway. And
amen.
Two,
right.
Exactly. And two, that KSM would be allowed to have these talking points and would excite jihad all over the world. That's kind of ridiculous. But Rubin's point is, and it's not from the left, because I think the right should say the same exact thing. That remember when Richard Nixon, I think, convicted, was it William Calley or the Tate-LoBianca murders, and he said he's guilty, and everybody went ballistic. Barack Obama and Attorney General Holder have already convicted KSM, and there was so much for the right of a free trial.
And yesterday, and finally, just such a very different topic, but it is something that I know a lot of people want to talk about. Jimmy, I'm just going to ask you this. Yesterday, of course, the diva of divas, Oprah Winfrey, announced she's going to shut down her syndicated show that's shown on the networks all across the country in 2011 after 25 seasons on the air. Jimmy, I know you've been heartbroken about this, and I just wonder if there's any way you could possibly recover from this loss.
And go
well,
on.
Well, I'm on record. I'm pretty down on Oprah as being, anti-black male, anti-family, and pro-Oprah. But that said, she brought something to the network that we hadn't ever seen before her. The reason she was able to kind of elbow Phil Donahue out the way is that she brought empathy and confessional TV into the zeitgeist. And, I don't know, we can argue whether that was a good thing or not, but I don't know who's going to take her place. I don't know if we need anybody to take her place, frankly.
Jimmy. Well, Jimmy Israel.
No, I'm glad that Jimmy approved that message because nobody else did. So.
Right, hey. No,
somebody can't take a place. After Allen Iverson has a very successful career on the New York Knicks that'll go on for at least 15 seconds, then he could have his own talk show.
Yeah, I was just down on the way. She truly didn't let people think for themselves, in my opinion.
Did she have truth serum coming through the airwaves?
Yeah, absolutely.
Please.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ruben. Final thought.
What you got to understand about Oprah is that she was told at the very beginning, 25-30 years ago, you're never going to have a career in television. You're the wrong color. You're overweight. All these things are a matter of fact. They come out in biographies about Oprah. And it's inspiring that she, lived by Evita Perón's 7-word mantra. It doesn't matter what the morons say, baby.
That's right. Tell
that's 8 words.
Viva Oprah.
Preach, Ruben. Ruben Navarrete is a syndicated columnist. He writes for CNN.com and the San Diego Union-Tribune. And he joined us from San Diego. We were also joined by Jimmy Israel, a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's also a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And he joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney. And Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor, our political junkie, and they both joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you all so much for joining us. I'm off next week to cook, so happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Peace. Gobble, gobble.
Speaking of being overweight and the wrong color, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks, our program.
Yep.
That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.